Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. This week, we'll follow up on the dramatic events when two historic buildings collapsed in Kelly last month, and we'll explore ways that such disasters can be avoided, as well as why they happen. My co-host in the studio is Paul Wearson. Really glad to have you with me today, Paul.
Well, speaking of collapsing, I feel better than that. But it does promise to be a good morning today, and I remember the first time we went to Kelly on a road trip, and we talked, and I think it was 2012, we spoke with Kenny Kling. And he's the mayor and fire chief and everybody important in Kelly.
Well, right now I bet he wishes he was someplace else because, as I learned from Ben Sveck, who is my main interview today, and he has a very interesting perspective, Ken Kling is really on the hot seat because he's the fire chief. The fire department is not part of the city government. So being mayor and fire chief, turns out that his two hats don't fit very well together.
Now, we might remind the audience that these buildings collapsed just a week ago Saturday. This was one building or two?
Two buildings. Yes, there was some confusion about the ages of the buildings and what they were used for. And Ben is a good person to talk to about that because his business, which is Falls Millwork, is in the building, one building over from the one that collapsed. Let's start our interview by stepping into his shop. We're in the shop of Ben Sveck in Kelly, and I'd like to ask you first about the building. Your building is right next door to the building that collapsed a couple weeks ago.
It's actually, there's a building in between, the B. Kelly Post Office.
Oh, I had read that the Kelly Post Office was actually in the building that collapsed,
no,
but it wasn't.
No, that's not true. Not true.
So that's why it was a little better maintained.
Marginally, yes.
Okay. And now just please describe the street that had all those buildings on it.
I haven't done the research that some of the old-timers in town have. When we bought this building in 1989, there was some indication that it was built around the 1900s.
Yes.
Sometime after the turn of the 20th century. But once again, if you look at the court records, it's very hard to determine when the building was actually built.
Well, we have an account from Mildred Brendeland of when she was a child. Mm-hmm. And this was, there were, you know, two hardware stores and, you know, multiple stores of all kinds and a lot of activity from farm people coming in. Literally on the ruts in the road, in the,
right,
through the fields. And there was a railroad going through at that time. So it was a booming little town. And I guess its high point must have been about the time these buildings were built or a little after.
I would guess, yeah. That would make sense that somebody, you know, invested in brick buildings. There were some wooden storefronts along here when we first came in, two or three, and they're gone now. They just...
So all four of these buildings then were originally brick or...
Yes, yeah. And there was... When we moved in, there was a little brick store across the street that was still standing. And that's probably the only reason they were standing is because they were brick. The wooden structures just, you know, they're no longer around.
But the buildings that are still standing, the post office and your building, are in good condition?
No, they're not in great shape. The building that collapsed seriously impacts what was the old post office. And it remains to be seen whether the current owner of the old post office will do what is required to stabilize it, at least.
For those of you who just tuned into Local Talk, we have been speaking with Ben Sveck of Falls Millwork in Kelly, whose business is just one door down from the buildings that collapsed there on April 18th. For an encouraging view on what communities facing such problems may be able to do to prevent them, we'll talk with Shelley Bernholtz, owner of Safe Building, a company in Slater that provides consulting and inspection services. And stay tuned for the second half of our program, in which we'll be talking about the 20th anniversary of the Ames Children's Choirs with Sylvia Munson, founder, Sean Stevenson, executive director, Sarah Compton, parent of one of the singers in the alumni choir, and Paul Hertz, current board president and another one of the alumni, who will be singing Saturday, May 9th at 3 p.m. Now, back to Kelly. Number one, when I came to Kelly, I knew from the discussions that I would be able to recognize Ben Speck's business, which is Falls Millwork, because it's right next to the demolished buildings. Well, my first confusion was I thought he had both buildings next to it, and the one that he refers to as the post office currently looks like a residence. It has curtains in the windows and nothing to indicate that it's anything else. And his business has no sign. I could figure out from looking at it that it must be have building materials inside, but there's no indication of what it is. And so I thought that was interesting, and I asked him about it, and he basically said, well, the people who come here don't come in off the street. They know we're here, and they come to our address, which incidentally is also not marked. So he manages to, for 25 years, have done a very good business with no sign and nothing but a location in Kelly. And the other thing I wanted to mention that we didn't discuss was on my way out the door, he showed me a historic photograph of these four buildings when they were new. And it's at a time when the street was dug up, they were laying the first water pipe, which gives you some idea of how old the water pipes are. Now, let's join Ben Speck again to hear his take on the water situation in Kelly. At the very same time that this story came out, the story on the Kelly water situation came out. And one of the things that Ken Kling was reported to say is we need that pressure, the pressure that would come from the water tower, and from a good, reliable water supply in order to really fight fires. Yes, we have to take, we have ways to take water out to
they have
farms,
tankers, right.
But if we're going to be fighting fires, we need the water pressure. And as someone with a business that is obviously very susceptible to fire, how do you feel about that?
I'm not really sure. The water situation has been going on for a number of years. I think really with this latest dust up, a wider span of people know about it, but they've been dealing with this water issue for a number of years. You know, the water tower is, I believe it's over 100 years old, and it was used when the city of Kelly bought it. The story that I've heard is that it came from a military installation, and they bought it and moved it and set it up here. So it's 100-plus years old. So it needs work. There was talk about drilling a secondary well out in the west end of town. It's just the problem with these little towns is they just don't have the resources. Infrastructure improvements cost so much that these little towns just can't do it. They don't have the bonding power. To do this second well, I think it would have tapped out the city of Kelly's borrowing ability probably for decades. So, and you know, and that sort of rolls into this problem here is that there are no resources to put toward even just cleaning this mess up here on the corner. The water thing I kind of stay out of because it's kind of a contentious issue locally. And so I pay my fire insurance premiums and hope for the best.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Ben. Now we have another guest with us who can throw some light on what towns can do when they face these issues and have a few more resources. We're going to be speaking with Shelley Bernholtz, who's from Slater. And hi, Shelley, are you with us now?
Good morning. Yes, I am.
Oh, well, I'm so glad that we could reach you because you were first recommended to me because you live in a historic building that you rehabbed, and I guess you have your business downstairs and your home upstairs, and I'd just like to know the story on that. Your business is actually involved with buildings that are in trouble, right? You do safety inspections?
Yes. We have a building code, safe building compliance and technology. It's actually a 501c3 nonprofit that is managed by my husband and I. So we have that as kind of it's probably the basis for our frame of reference for the whole project, because we've been doing this work for about 8 years. And over about the last 3 years, we've been looking to find a building for our business and also a home for our family over in Slater. So when this building became available, we thought that there was potential to get, you know, kind of kill two birds with one stone. And as it turned out, the city of Slater was also very proactive in trying to help us, you know, make this project a success. They not only helped us with negotiations for the previous owner, but also have a Main Street revitalization program that helped us finance some of the project.
So I noticed from your website you have 18 communities and agencies in Iowa that you provide services to?
Yes. We mainly, the bulk of what we do for our communities is building code inspections. And so for communities that might be, you know, a little bit smaller, that don't necessarily have the budget for a full-time building inspector, we contract with those communities and we take care of new permits, so any new houses or additions or decks that are being built, we actually process the building permits and inspect. We also provide, you know, rental inspections for rental properties in a couple of our communities. And then we also help our communities with what can be considered either nuisance or dilapidated buildings and properties in order to kind of get the ball rolling on either getting them repaired or getting them torn down as a last resort.
Now, what is the smallest community you contract with?
Well, I think that our very newest community is a community called University Park, and they have less than 500 population. So, but they do have some building code activity, and they wanted, you know, a certified agency that had experienced, skilled inspectors to be able to take that on, because previously their city council had been kind of taking care of it, and you know, many of them felt like they just didn't have the knowledge and experience to do building code. So that is probably our smallest. I think our average city population is probably between 1,000 and 5,000, something like that.
Obviously, Kelly was not one of your clients, right?
We do not work with the city of Kelly currently, no.
Now, from the description that Ben Sveck gave us, it sounds like Kelly's problems are, because of its size, their financial problems. That this, I had an interview with him yesterday afternoon, incidentally in the rain, so some of these segments may, since he has a metal roof, have a little special noise.
Although I guess there are lots of disagreements in Kelly because of, you know, problems like the one next door and like not having enough money to do
that's
the necessary
really the
things.
Big, I think that's the biggest problem, is that the resources are limited and it has to be allocated, you know, in the best way possible. And I think that's where the friction comes. If resources were not an issue, everybody would get what they want.
Yes.
You know, and there wouldn't be this sort of maneuvering for, you know, this project over that project.
So that's probably a statement of, to some extent, I guess, everybody faces limitations on their resources. Is that right, Shelley?
I agree, and I think for small cities that this really can be a big issue and a big problem. You know, the city of Slater, one of the reasons that they are as proactive as they are is because they've had this situation happen, and they've had buildings that ended up collapsing, and then the city had to be responsible for the cleanup, which ended up being, you know, over, I think, four or five buildings, it ended up being hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so they really, really felt it is important to catch these buildings before they get to that situation, and that they would much rather, invest a little bit in keeping those historic buildings maintained and up in their community rather than having to clean up the rubble. One of the big considerations is that a lot of these older buildings are going to have asbestos or, those kinds of environmental considerations. And so that just increases the expense on any kind of removal that you might have to do.
Well, that really fits in with something that Ben said about the situation in Kelly. So could we listen to that little bit?
It's my understanding that the owner of record of the building that collapsed was an elderly woman who died maybe 4 or 5 years ago. According to the current county record, she's still the owner of the building. I believe the taxes are in arrears, and it's possible that there are several liens on the building. So it's essentially been an abandoned building since she moved out, went into a care center, and never came back. And that's been four or five years.
And had there been an approval to demolish it, it would have been demolished some time ago?
Well, the trouble with demolishing a building like that is the cost. It's tens of thousands of dollars to take a building like that down, haul away the debris, and then fill in the cellar, the foundation. And certainly the family that owned the building doesn't have the resources to do that. I don't believe the city of Kelly has the resources to do that, because you would spend tens of thousands of dollars to clean it up, and then you have an empty lot that's probably worth less than $10,000. So what is that worth to anyone?
So now it's stabilized in the sense that the dangerous debris is...
Well, it can't fall any farther.
It can't fall any farther.
It's still a hazard. I mean, you saw it when you came in.
Yes.
And it's not really fenced off. There's been some talk about the possibility that there was asbestos in the building, which was not mitigated. And so if that is the case, then that whole pile of stuff could potentially be toxic, be classified as toxic debris. And now because it's all mixed together, there's no separating it out.
Now, it's all on the city's plate, right?
I'm not clear on that, because I got called the morning that it collapsed to come down just to make sure that our building was okay, and when I got here, the fire department was in control of the scene, and I don't believe that the city of Kelly really was involved, other than the fact that the fire chief is also the mayor.
Yes.
So, but I don't know whose operation it was, but by all appearances, it was a fire department operation, not a city of Kelly. The fire department here is not part of the city. It's a separate entity. It's the West Story. I'm not sure what their formal name is.
I see.
They're not part of the city of Kelly government. It's a, I don't know if it's a private or, but it's separate.
I see.
So there were two potential entities, the city of Kelly or the fire department, and it seemed like the fire department had taken control of that.
Well, Shelley, did that sound familiar to you? Have you ever run into anything quite that dire?
Well, there have been some situations that are similar to that in some of our communities. And I know in one in particular, there was a partial collapse of a building with an owner who was willing to make some repairs but reluctant to do so in a building code compliant manner. So the city ended up having us inspect that building, provide them a report, and that situation actually ended up in court with our inspector testifying as to what the deficiencies of the building were, and the judge did end up ruling in the favor of the city that property owner had to correct those deficiencies and had to do that with a building permit and appropriate inspections and that sort of thing. And one other thing I thought I'd mention is that there are a few resources, and we utilize those for our project here in Slater through the Department of Natural Resources. They have one program that's called the Brownfield Rehabilitation Program, I think is what that is, and that is a program that will help with costs for asbestos testing, environmental hazards testing for a building or a site. And then they also have a program that's called the Derelict Building Program, and it's a grant program where you can apply for funds to help with either tearing down a building or rehabbing a building and, you know, say getting a new roof for it or that sort of thing. So both those programs are utilized here in Slater, and they were very helpful in you know, helping us understand what the environmental dangers are, and then helping us with some really really basic things that really are the first things you need to do. You know, you really need to get a good roof on a building. Once water starts to infiltrate, that's just going to really speed up the dilapidation. So they have those two programs available, and they were really helpful. So they're available to any community, and I just think that's something I wanted, you know, people to know about.
Oh, well, thank you. And I think this must, since our listeners presumably are in a 7-county area and they must have some of these issues in many, many communities, I'm sure that it's good to know that there are things you can do when you face a situation like the one that happened in Kelly. Maybe too late for Kelly. We're kind of pulling to the end of our time. One thing, though, that I would like to have you talk about before we leave is you do a little recycling of materials when they come out. And I wonder if in some cases are these historic materials, like Ben Speck had on his website a staircase that they had taken out of a building being demolished and then reconstructed somewhere else. Do you have any things like that?
We do, and that was one of the goals of our project here, was to, first of all, save as much as we could of the original building, and then also as we were, you know, as we were deconstructing before we were able to build back, you know, we had two tin roofs, or two tin ceilings, one on the lower level, one on the upper level. We saved, you know, as much of that as we could. There was also a great deal of lumber, an amazing amount of lumber that was in place just to hold that tin ceiling up. So as we took that down, we saved that, and then we've got some items around the building where you can see that, refurbished wood. We've got some countertops in our office that are made out of that, some tables that were made out of that. And of course, you know, this kind of project takes a while. We've only been in about a year now, and we've still got some finishing things to do. So we've got some stacks of tin and some lumber that we're going to be using, you know, throughout the rest of our renovation, just kind of the final renovation of our project. And then we did also recycle everything we could as we were taking it out. So there was a huge number of like appliances, furnaces, water heaters that were just in. So we, you know, made sure that got to the right recycling area. And our co-op here in town even helped us, because they allowed us to bring our vehicle and our trailer in ahead of time and weigh it, and then we could bring it in with the materials on it and weigh it, so that we could actually provide a report to the DNR that we recycled this many tons of material. You know, we called Greater Des Moines Habitat for Humanity. They got to come in and kind of have their pick of everything else that we knew we weren't going to use. So they grabbed, you know, several hundred pounds worth of items and took it to their restore. And so that was really an important part for us too, and if you stop by 421 Main, you'll get to see some of that.
421 Main in Slater. Wow. Well, that's a nice companion story to the Kelly story. And thank you so much for being with us to tell us that one.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to share today.
Thank you. I'd like to close with a little reverie about what happens when you lose your post office. Because one of the buildings that remained standing was the post office, and it's not anymore.
when the post office was next door, if you lived inside town, you came to the post office to get your mail. And so there was life on the street every day, all day long. There were people pulling up, you know, and they would go in, get their mail, and I would interact, you know, to the degree that I was in and out the front. Not a lot. I have some good friends down here, even just locals, and they stop in from time to time, and we just chat about things. I really like it here. It's been a very good fit for me.
Are there any other kinds of businesses that you think could fulfill the function of the post office? I know it was a big loss to Kelly to lose that post office.
Yeah, those are sort of the death throes of little towns, I think, you know, when they lose an institution like that.
Yeah,
but the loss of the elementary schools. I mean, it's not just these little towns, too. I mean, we have that in Ames with the neighborhood schools going away. But when you're in a little town with only one school.
When that's the center of your town.
They're social anchors. And that's what the post office was. I mean, it was more than just the post office. It was a social anchor of the town. And it was the last one left, really. And when that was gone, you know, there was always life out on the street during the day, and since it closed, it's just dead. I come and I go, and I rarely see people driving by, like locals driving by, and I wait, but there's no real interaction with them anymore, the way there was when the post office was here.
That's a story that there's nothing you can do about the post office's closing, Shelley, but it's great to know that you can save the buildings in and save their parts that people can continue to use and enjoy. So thank you so much. Just give us your address again and your phone number so if people need to reach you, if they can.
Sure, and thank you so much for having me this morning. Our address is 421 Main Street in Slater, Iowa, and our office phone number is 515-333-4161.
And that was Shelley Bernholz, right?
Shelley Bernholz.
And
Safe Building.
Safe, yes. SAFE, right?
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And
well, this is KHOI Community Radio. And your hosts for today are Susan Franson and myself, Paul Wearson. Now, in the first half of our program, we've been talking with Ben Sveck from Kelly and Shelley Bernholz from Slater about all the infrastructure problems and changes and facing small towns, derelict buildings. And as a matter of fact, this morning when I got up for about 10 minutes, I felt like a derelict building. So I'm feeling better every moment now. And now we're going to play a selection from the Ames Children's Choirs and to introduce Sylvia Munson, the founder of the Children's Choirs in Ames, John Stevenson, executive director, and Paul Hertz, a board member for the Ames Children's Choirs, and they're going to tell us about plans for the 20th anniversary of the Ames Children's Choirs, and that will be this coming Saturday and Sunday, May 9th and 10th, occurring at the First Methodist Church, 516 Kellogg Avenue, here in downtown Ames.
So, bis du mir.
Sylvia, Paul Wearson here. How are you?
I'm just fine, Paul.
It's good to talk to another Story Cityan.
That's right.
And you're going to fly in tomorrow. You might tell us about the days when you founded the Ames Children's Choirs. You know, you have to start from scratch. And tell us a little bit about how that happened.
Well, I was living in Tucson at the time and had a children's choir program there for about 9 years. And the opportunity came to come to Iowa State to be involved in music education. And since I'd had working with children as being my passion and what I'd done throughout my career, it was very hard for me to leave Tucson and my choir program there. But I thought if I could go back into the university and have that be part of teacher training, that would be a win-win situation for all of us. So, and because I knew Central Iowa very well, when they say you can never go home, well, I decided that I could go back to my roots in Central Iowa because I knew of the focus for good music, good education, and that Ames didn't have a children's choir program. I'd been founding children's choirs everywhere that I went when I was in Western Maryland and then Tacoma and in Arizona. So I decided I would start a program there and have it be part of teacher training. So as soon as I arrived, I got a few key people on board as kind of an advisory board because it was just run out of my office, so to speak, and knew some of the teachers, met other teachers, found out who they were, sent out notices, put notices in the paper, and had a call for auditions. And I believe the call for auditions, it was occurring in September because I couldn't really notify people until the very beginning of the school year. So we had auditions, and there were about 40 children that we had, 35 or so, or 40, that we had singing in the very first choir. And it was from teacher recommendations and from newspaper ads. So we got it started in probably towards the third week or so of September, and we were off and running.
And no regrets and no looking back?
Just had wonderful colleagues to work with there and just remarkable young singers that I had the privilege of working with. So it was actually any one of us that's involved in education, working with children. We all know it's working with them or for them is a labor of love. So there's only a feeling of being privileged to have worked with so many fine young singers and a wonderful supportive community.
And you have the distinction of founding an organization that continues today, and also that's going to be something that you've got to be happy about, that continued after you left and continues today.
Yes. I think that's one thing that has been a topic of conversation among some of my friends, children's choir conductor friends. When we are at conferences, most of us were in a position where when you founded a choir, this really started, children's choirs really started becoming a significant part of ACDA, American Choral Directors. And I would say in the 70s, a lot of choirs were founded. And I think that our concern has been, well, what's going to happen after you've been in a community and how are you going to be able to maintain that program and have it continue? So it's really rewarding to know that that has happened. Because I know when I was in Arizona, here I was in Tucson, and the program folded because they weren't able to find anyone to take it over at that point. They already had a Tucson Girls Chorus and Tucson Boys Chorus, so it was it wasn't as if there wasn't going to be any organization, and Tucson was a large city. So now to have this program be able to continue is very gratifying.
And, you know, to take it into the current era, we have Sean Stevenson, who is here today. She's the executive director. And Paul Hertz is a board member. And we also have Sarah Compton, whose daughter has been active here. And maybe, Sean, you could give us a little update on what's happening in the modern era here for the Ames Children's Choirs?
Well, the choirs have a variety of performances throughout the community. They always have a holiday concert and a spring concert, and we are approaching our annual spring concert, but we've added a special event as we're celebrating our 20th anniversary with this alumni concert the day before. Both concerts will be this weekend at the First United Methodist Church downtown at 3 p.m., one on Saturday, May 9th, and one on Sunday, May 10th. And we're very much looking forward to bringing back alumni who have chosen music as their life's profession and have offered to come back from as far as Colorado and Texas, Minnesota, to perform and honor Dr. Munson as she returns with their performances. And we're just looking for a spectacular event that day on May 9th.
It's going to be fantastic, and I'm a real fan of the Ames Children's Choirs. You know, to see the precision and the discipline and the beautiful sound. Throughout history, the voices of children have been prized. Look at the great children's choirs from the Vatican and the St. Peter's Basilica. And it's just a unique sound, and I really, really enjoy that. And everyone knows about the Vienna Boys Choir.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Paul Hertz, you're a board member. Tell us what the board's doing now, what your role is.
Well, I am actually president of the board.
Congratulations.
Right now.
I didn't remember the election.
and my term is almost over. It's just for 1 year. But we've been doing a lot to raise awareness of the Ames Children's Choirs, make sure that more of the community is aware we exist. We've been trying some new things. We had a musical theater camp, summer camp, last August, and we'll be doing it again. And that really was an initiative of our concert choir conductor, Jade Fox. But we've got, as Sean said, lots of different events throughout the year.
And it's a big issue, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That's really the administration of the organization and making sure it's in a good place to be sustainable. One of our new initiatives, which relates to our concerts this weekend, is the Sylvia Munson Honor Prize. We are initiating it's essentially a scholarship in honor of our founding director. And yeah, and I'm not just a board member of the Children's Choirs. I am an alumnus. I sang well, not quite in the first year of the chorus, but I sang, in the third and fourth years of the children's choir.
And that had to be an influence on you.
Oh,
and,
yes.
You know, Paul is also an accomplished organist and composer, so certainly being in the children's choir had to be one of those things that aimed you toward music as a vocation and something that you love. I want to bring in someone else today, too. We have Sarah Compton, who's here. And your daughter's been involved, I believe.
She has. She also was not in the very first year, but the second year and going forward. And it was a significant impact in her life, I would say. It really helped focus in her aspirations in music. And there's so much more than just singing that goes on in the Ames Children's Choir. And I think that was one of the things as a parent that we really loved about the Ames Children's Choir was all the entire benefit, not beyond musical, but they really learned, you know, practice makes perfect, and all the discipline and the friendships, and in fact, in deciding whether or not she could come back for the alumni concert. Of course, they've all moved on. All these kids have moved on to very busy lives. And she said, I can't not come. It has been such an important part of my life that I have to be there. So we knew that was a good testimony.
Oh, yes. And look at that loyalty she has, the great memories she has, and the memory of practice and work ethic and understanding that perfection and achievement comes from hard work.
Absolutely. And certainly her dearest friends were in that choir. They really worked through life together, and it was very formative for her. And I think that continues for all the kids that are involved.
That's great to hear, Sarah.
May I just throw in a story?
Yes, is that Sylvia?
Well, actually, Sarah had two daughters, both Jennifer.
She did. I did. Yeah, I do have. I continue to have two daughters, and they both sing.
But it is interesting, since I moved to Utah, that Kathy invited me to come to Colorado, where she is now, and she's running a community music program, and wanted me to help with the children's choir and do a workshop for area teachers and students at the university. And so it was coming full circle, because Kathy and I talked about the very first solo she had with ACC. It was when she was in sixth grade, and she sang Jada, because we did a review of World War I songs. So she sang the verses of Jada. And then to come and have followed her career, certainly even at Iowa State, when she was a student there, and then from her continued work through graduate school and the Fulbright, here I was in Colorado, and she decided, I think, that we were going to do the Mozart Laudate Dominum for church. And so here I got to accompany this remarkable voice, absolutely remarkable. So to have heard her, and this is true of so many of the singers, I would hear them as fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth graders, when they're absolutely wonderful singers and great, they could be great artists, but they're just emerging singers. I mean, real singers know that you don't really start singing till you're really in your 20s. And so it just was wonderful to have that kind of full circle experience with Kathy.
Yeah, her voice changed a lot between sixth grade.
It changed a lot.
Yeah. So it was, and Sylvia, I mean, I can't emphasize enough, and in fact, for both of our daughters, Jennifer, our younger daughter, did not pursue music as a career, but certainly Ames Children's Choirs was a significant portion of her formative years as well. And she would tell you she learned a lot about life in the Ames Children's Choir.
Well, and I think that is something I always tried to focus on, was that the focus was to raise the self-esteem of each child, each person, and it was through music. So through that development of them as a musician, but also as a person, that's what really brings them to a place where they feel good about themselves. And some of those friendships, even when I was in Colorado, Kathy had told me, now someone's coming for dinner. We were going to meet someplace, and I was trying to think, now who could it be? And in came Anna Zaffirano. Not Anna.
Julia.
Julia Zaffirano. And here Julia's living in the Denver area. And so there are those friendships. They had gone to the Czech Republic together. And so there are those long-term friendships. It's so much fun to see.
Well, they really learn about working together and working as part of something bigger than themselves. And I think that's one of the big benefits. And they really carry that forward.
And I just wanted to point out that we're encouraging all of the alumni to come back to the May 10th concert on Sunday afternoon, and they will actually be able to jump in with the Mass Choir and sing Dream a Dream, which was a traditional piece that concluded many of our concerts. And so we encourage all alumni to come back Sunday afternoon, and we are showing about a 10-minute video that's entitled Remembrances, 20-Year Remembrances, that's been put together by one of our board members, Sinyen Zhang Durbin. And it will be a wonderful presentation from 1995 to 2015, and you won't want to miss that.
It sounds like a great occasion, and just think how thrilling it'll be for those who are coming back as alumni of the organization, the renewing of friendships, and I think another treat to see kids who are there today, to know that this is continuing. Now, what are the ages of the children in the choir, Sean?
The ages start at age 8 and go all the way up to age 18. Certainly girls can continue singing until they're seniors in high school. The boys' voices obviously will change and they will not be able to continue that long, but we have singers from age 8 to 18.
I didn't know they went that high to age 18. And there's more than one choir.
Yes, we have three choirs. They're primarily age-based. Preparatory choir is 8 to 8 to 10-year-olds. The chorale is 10 to 12-year-olds, and the concert choir is 12 on up.
And is the concert choir, that's the one that tours?
The concert choir does tour, although the younger choirs have chances to do what we call a touring experience. The prep choir does a half-day church tour. The chorale does a one-day tour that usually involves a shared concert with another children's choir. So all choirs have a chance to kind of get out and perform.
And they've been all over the place. And Sylvia, you might recall some of the great places the Ames Children's Choirs have performed and toured.
Well, one of the interesting things when you talk about the beginning of the program, there was a lot of excitement and support from the community. And during our the summer after our first year going into our second year, there was a partnership, Sister City Partnership, that was established with the Czech Republic at that time, and we were asked to perform for the delegation. So it was in the very beginning of our second year, we came in and performed for the delegation when they were actually signing the documents to become partner cities. And after that performance, people came up to me and asked us to come to their festival. And at that point, the first year, all we did was a one-day school tour. So we had one full day of doing four schools and maybe a retirement community. And I just said, well, we haven't even been out of the state of Iowa yet. So was it possible for us to delay that? So we were making plans for our second year to go to Chicago. So after that full tour experience of going to Chicago, I felt it would be better and parents might be more supportive of understanding what's going on. And so then we were invited our third year to go to the Czech Republic and had great parent support for that. But what a remarkable opportunity for those young singers. I mean, that's another aspect of their development.
Oh, yes,
to have these opportunities to perform with other ensembles from around the world. We were in the Czech Republic for a couple of weeks. We sang in a festival in Vancouver, British Columbia, and spent 2 weeks there and in the Pacific Northwest. We did a festival in Denver and spent 2 weeks in Utah and Colorado, Washington, D.C., Carnegie Hall to do the premiere of John Rutter's Mass of the Children. So even within the United States, there are some pretty remarkable experiences, I think, that the singers enjoyed and certainly learned from.
Well, thank you very much, Sylvia. You know, this is an opportunity for kids that continues today. Thank you for founding. And all of the touring you talked about and all of the things happening today is all wrapped up in the song they usually use as a finale, Dream the Dream. And let's hear that one.
I'd like to jump in and just say something about how the alumni concert came to be. It was actually a suggestion of an alum after we had an idea of having a reception honoring Dr. Munson. And then Jonathan Gregoire suggested that we start this and have this alumni concert. And I myself am performing on that.
Very
but,
good.
Yes, let's hear.
Dream the dream.
Dream a dream.
Oh,
Oh, what fun we've had today on the program. We began today talking with folks about crises in small towns and collapsing buildings and all the building inspections that need to be done. We were talking with Ben Sveck from Kelly and Shelley Bernholz from Slater. And in our last segment, we talked about the Ames Children's Choirs. And our guests were Sylvia Munson, the founder, Sean Stevenson, executive director, Paul Hertz of the board, and we had Sarah Compton, who's a parent of an alumnus of the choir, reminding you the 20th anniversary concert for the Ames Children's Choirs will be coming up this Saturday and Sunday, May 9th and 10th, at the First Methodist Church at 516 Kellogg downtown. Concerts at 3 p.m., so thanks to our guests today.
And the music you've heard today was Bis Du Meer and Dream a Dream, sung by the Ames Children's Concert Choir. And thanks to Rebecca Brown, our engineer, and to our Kelly correspondent, B.J. Kearns, Paul Wearson, and I, Susan Franz, and thanks all of you for listening and for all you did to make our fund drive last week a success. We made our financial goal of $15,000, so a special thank you to all who became members or renewed your membership. See you again on the radio.